From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Here's John McCain in Wednesday's presidential debate.
We need to know the full extent of Senator Obama's relationship with Acorn, who is now on the verge of maybe perpetrating one of the greatest frauds in voter history in this country, maybe destroying the fabric of democracy.
Stinging, but as fact checkers quickly demonstrated, not true. The fraud was probably against Acorn by some low-wage employees, apparently trying to avoid the tedious job of canvassing for actual prospective voters. Now, here's Barack Obama.
And 100%, John, of your ads, 100% of them have been negative.
It's not true. 100,
it absolutely is true.
No siree. As fact-checkers reported, in one recent week, McCain's ads were 100% negative, but not over the entire campaign. Yes, among other historic aspects, this is the most fact-checked presidential race ever, yet by no means the most factual. Writing for Politico.com this week, Daniel Libet sees facts everywhere and nary a drop to drink.
You have a proliferation of organizations now and websites. Factual assertion or rhetorical statement that is being said in this campaign. And the question is whether or not this is creating somewhat of a white noise effect.
That it all becomes a bunch of blather to the voter.
Yes, if dozens and dozens of statements on a daily basis are pointed out to be untrue, are the crucial ones rising to the top? Are people really getting to the heart of the inaccuracies in the presidential campaign?
Let's talk about movie ads for a moment, because we're all familiar with the idea of a bad or lukewarm review for a movie being cherry-picked by a movie studio to pull out three words that make it look like the reviewer has given eight thumbs up to a real bomb. The political campaigns do the same thing with the words of the fact-checkers.
You're absolutely correct, and that happened with factcheck.org when the McCain campaign had sort of used one of factcheck.org's assertions in an advertisement. They're misquoting the fact-checkers themselves.
The attacks on Governor Palin have been called completely false, misleading, and they've just begun.
And they sort of used it out of context, and factcheck.org wrist-slapped them for this. But then, of course, how many people are going back to factcheck.org to make sure that that claim is not being misrepresented? Relatively few. So the McCain campaign can sort of get away with it.
Now, media critics, and this program perhaps more than most, have spent a lot of time criticizing news organizations for neutrally reporting assertions by politicians without taking the trouble to investigate whether the assertions are true. Now, in a fact-check universe, we're finally getting what we asked. They're doing the due diligence, but it doesn't seem to be doing any good. In fact, you know, as we've just discussed, it may actually be making some of the problems worse. What should news organizations be doing?
What is required now is a way of kind of consolidating the fact-checking. And this gives an opportunity, maybe even for a website, to do what websites like 538.com or Pollster.com or Real Clear Politics have done for polling. You have all these different polls, and you need sites to bring it all together so you can line it all up and make some sense out of it, and also so that it really can attract your average voter.
Now, on the question of false equivalency, in this campaign, for example, I can certainly demonstrate that the Obama campaign has misrepresented John McCain's position on stem cell research. But at the same time, McCain has been just absolutely scurrilous and spurious in asserting or at least implying terrorism connections to Obama with respect to this guy, Bill Ayers. Is not one of the dangers of fact-checking that it doesn't make distinction between the magnitude of lies?
Journalism is supposed to be objective in approach, but of course it's subjective in selection. The fact-checkers who I spoke with, the sort of the leaders of the pack, were saying that they just do it as they do everything else, just as you would during a morning meeting of a newspaper editorial staff, decide what gets on the front page, what gets above the fold. so do the fact checkers decide what things deserve to be on their blogs or on their website that day. But yes, while we are taking more of an assertive role in identifying and calling a spade, so to speak, are we doing enough to really make the proportional argument of which deceptions or inaccuracies deserve which kind of coverage? And I don't think we've come to that point where we have.
One final thing I want to ask you. Take the Sarah Palin assertion that she said thanks but no thanks to the Bridge to Nowhere. The media have since demonstrated to a fairly well that Governor Palin was a supporter of the project until it had essentially died in Congress. And yet, she is out on the stump every day using the same now famous quote. Does this suggest that the whole exercise is just kind of a waste of time?
Well, I think we need to acknowledge, first of all, that the McCain campaign, as of this current moment, is down in the polls, you know, and there has been this collective narrative about their not even passing, as Karl Rove had said, you know, the 100% truth test. So I don't want to lend the impression that this is not having any effect, even though the campaign might be resistant to changing their language. They're not getting away with it necessarily. I think the polls would suggest otherwise.
Daniel Libet is a writer for Politico.com. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's great to be with you, Bob. Take care.
When millions of Latinos across the country took to the streets over immigration reform in 2006, signs read, "Today we march, tomorrow we vote." That tomorrow is almost here again, and nearly 18 million Latinos are registered, ready, and representing much of the swing in some swing states. So, of course, the candidates are targeting them, but not as an ethnic monolith. Federico Saberbi, author of The Mass Media and Latino Politics, says the candidates have run essentially parallel campaigns this year, with Spanish-language ads targeted at specific communities in battleground districts. Conservative Cubans in Florida get one ad, more liberal Mexicans in New Mexico another. But they do have at least one thing in common: negativity.
The approach for the McCain camp for the Florida area is demonizing Obama as being someone who would be willing to talk to Chavez, the president of Venezuela, of someone who would probably open the doors to talking to these left-wing dictators and these communists, someone who would eliminate the free trade agreement. So that's the approach there. You move to New Mexico, Colorado, and Nevada, and just to take the example of New Mexico, the main spot that's being aired on Spanish language radio is the anti-Obama spot, saying that Obama was responsible for the lack of immigration reform, which you wouldn't hear in California, nor in Texas, nor in other parts of the country.
Have you noticed whether they have a different message for Spanish voters than they do for English language ones?
What we've noticed is that in the Spanish spots, compared to previous years, there's more of the we and the us in the text of the messages. There is more of the what we, the immigrant, can do. You don't hear those words, those we, the us, spoken by the respective candidates in the general market English language spots directed to the rest of the population.
When George W. Bush made a serious effort to reach out to Latino voters, he won 35% of their vote in 2000. What was his strategy?
The biggest difference for Bush is that he brought in Sonia Cohen, who did an outstanding job in public relations, getting a lot of free media, allowing him to be accessible to Latino-oriented media. And that was not the case in previous campaigns by any Republican. One of the interesting stories of the previous campaigns was how Al Gore was asked by one of his Latino media strategists to provide videotape of Al Gore reaching out, shaking hands with Latino community leaders. Well, I think that that Latino strategist is still waiting for those videos, which were nowhere to be found. Meanwhile, Bush had pictures of himself hugging, kissing Latino babies and moms and all of that, and they could produce that, whereas the Democrats were aloof and distant and didn't have that connection. This year, they're making a bigger effort, a much greater effort compared to previous years.
George Bush seemed to at least know his way around a tamale. I understand that he ate that fine, whereas many years earlier, Gerald Ford, eating his, failed to unwrap the corn husk.
That's true. And it was the talk of the town when it was like, oh, this is kind of rough, isn't it? And, well, yes, Mr. President, you're supposed to unwrap it first.
You talked about the Latino youth. There were massive demonstrations in 2006 to protest changes in immigration policy, and these demonstrations were spurred in large part by local radio and the internet. These media were really powerful in organizing young Latinos. Was this a new thing, a breakthrough?
Breakthrough in the galvanizing of that youth all over the country all at once. Now they're getting the same emphasis to get Latinos to register and vote.
So have the campaigns picked up on these media tools to get young Latinos on their side?
Certainly so. The Obama campaign in particular has a blueprint for the Latino community, and it goes page by page over the issues: education, immigration reform, housing. In the McCain website, you don't find as rich of information.
During the election season, we have all these ads, and in the last few election cycles, we've had a whole bunch of media outlets and independent groups fact-checking those ads. But, of course, it's in English. Has Univision or anyone else taken on the fact-checking job in Spanish?
Not that I know. And there's two big gaps when it comes to Latino political communication. One of them is precisely this: assessing what is right and what is wrong of the spots and the strategies of the candidates to get the Latino vote. The other gap is with research to assess what are the effects of these spots and other media outreach. We don't have people doing the polling on a regular basis with panels and cohorts of Latinos to say, after these spots, there was a shift or there was not a shift in the voting pattern of Latinos. That does not exist out there.
Federico, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Federico Saberbi is a professor at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication, Texas State University, San Marcos, and the author of The Mass Media and Latino Politics.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Welcome back to the most news in the morning. If you were watching the debate last night on CNN, you saw instant feedback on the debate as it was taking place in real time.
The Democrats, if you watch those lines on CNN, are ahead on Iraq.
You know, Jeffrey, really is fascinating to watch this instant feedback with the dial meters on the bottom of the screen.
Along with the usual expert debate analysis from pundits, polls, and reporters, CNN this year has been offering a novel kind of instant feedback. Squiggly lines like threads of DNA spooled across the bottom of your TV screen. The lines represent the real-time reactions of a panel of undecided voters, each equipped with a dial meter to register his or her moment-to-moment reaction to the candidate's remarks. Statistically speaking, it is entirely irrelevant, but it's possibly influential nonetheless. Research suggests that merely observing the opinions of others may influence your own. Media reporter Sam Schechner wrote about this effect for the Wall Street Journal, and he joins us. Sam, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
I just don't think we can emphasize enough the notion that the response of a room of 24 people is essentially meaningless. I am correct about that, am I not?
It might be a relatively good measure of how those people in the room feel, but if you're trying to abstract to undecided voters as a whole, you know, even the people who conduct it aren't looking for that kind of data. They're trying to figure out how certain kinds of phrases or arguments go over with people in general, but they're not building any broad consensus about who won the debate or who's performing better.
And if there were a different selection of 24 people in the room, chances are the squiggles would go in entirely different ways.
Yes, although they go out of their way to find people who are really claim to be undecided. The people who are doing this are CNN or two researchers from SMU and from thousands of voters in the Ohio area. They cull this group of 25 or 30 voters to the point where they're searching on LexisNexis, searching on Facebook to see if they have any political leanings, and constantly encouraging them to drop out if, in fact, they are decided. But obviously, there's going to be a lot of variation.
Okay, so I saw this quote from Nora Ephron, the writer and sometimes director, who said that, yeah, she knows it's not statistically significant, but she can't help being affected by what the squiggles say, especially when they validate her own reaction. She is not alone, I gather.
I'm certainly with her on it. I can't keep my eyes off of it. McCain makes a joke, and I want to know if the sarcasm played well or not, and your heart rises and falls with it. But there's certainly also a body of research that shows that people get affected by this sort of on-screen live display, too.
Tell me about the research.
Well, in one study conducted at Williams College, a professor used dial meters, much like the ones on CNN, with a group of 94 students who were watching excerpts of a 1984 debate between Reagan and Mondale. And half of those students were in a room where the on-screen feedback, which they thought was their own, was manipulated to be pro-Reagan, and the other half were in a room where it was manipulated to be pro-Mondale. They thought that what they were seeing was their own reaction, but in fact, in the other room, the professors saw that as the manipulated feedback went up, 2 seconds later, the students would follow it. And after the fact, most people told the researchers that they had not been influenced at all, but that wasn't in fact true. Those students who saw the pro-Reagan feedback were almost 3 times more likely to say they would have voted for Reagan, and those who saw the pro-Mondale feedback were almost 2 times more likely to say they would have voted for Mondale.
Now, there was another experiment of audience reaction of another sort, namely the live audience reaction, laughter and applause. This was the Reagan-Mondale debate, in which Reagan got off one of the great debate zingers of all time.
I will not make age an issue of this campaign. I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience.
What the experiment did was show 2 versions of that debate to students, one with the audience reaction and one without the audience reaction. And in the one with the audience reaction, Reagan won by a 4-1 margin. But when the cheers were stripped out, the victory was heavily Mondale's. So just hearing what in essence was the laugh track back in those days had a pretty profound effect on at least the participants in this study.
Now, there's one other debate that researchers looked at. This was 1992, involving George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and H. Ross Perot.
This is an interesting experiment, in part because it provides some evidence that these effects are at play in a real election, not just in an experimental setting. This was the night of that actual debate. A bunch of students were convened to watch it, actually right after the debate ended. And they were either in a room with people who were instructed to clap for Clinton and jeer Bush, or in a room instructed to clap for Bush and jeer Clinton. And, you know, being on a college campus, Clinton's performance was rated more highly on average in both rooms. And actually, there was another room where nobody was cheering for anybody, and he was rated more highly there, too. But in the pro-Bush room, Bush's performance was rated nearly double after the fact, putting him almost on par with Clinton. And Clinton's performance edged up slightly with encouragement from the audience. So, you know, if you look at the bar chart, it's a massive difference. Bush almost pulls even in terms of how people reacted, just based on the people who were sitting next to them.
Which is perhaps one reason why live audiences at the debates this time around have been instructed by the moderators to sit on their hands and keep their mouths shut. Now, Sam, we have established that the squiggly lines do not represent any statistically significant data. And if this research is correct, we've established that people are influenced by the squiggly lines. Does that not mean that it is journalistically irresponsible to put them on the TV? I mean, is CNN doing the right thing in adding this feature to its coverage?
We're social animals. We process information in the context of the people around us. We do watch our debates with friends or at a bar or in some sort of group environment frequently, in part because we want to hear the reactions of other people. That's in part why Nora Ephron and you and I can't stop looking at that CNN line on the bottom of the screen. I think it's hard to argue necessarily that it's a bad thing. In fact, the people who do it, the professors at SMU, see it as a way of shifting some of the balance of influence from pundits, who have been shown to be able to have a pretty strong effect with their pre- and post-debate spin and how they set expectations and frame the debates, to actual voters. And even if it's not a statistically significant sample size. These are real people, and them versus Andrea Mitchell, doesn't necessarily mean that one is better than the other.
Sam, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Sam Schechner is a media reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
Reporters often have to wade through a river of ethical dilemmas, and when they're working undercover, that river can become a swamp. Even their colleagues don't approve of what they're doing, and their targets, well, here's a clip we found on YouTube of what happened when an NBC Dateline reporter working undercover at DEF CON, a conference of underground hackers, was unmasked.
I'm not cool with that, especially when they turn down the opportunity to get a press badge. So, I need a show of hands, a new contest, spot the undercover reporter.
A crowd of jeering hackers followed as she bolted from the building.
Thanks for playing!
To catch a reporter!
Come back next year.
Give our love to the editor!
Harper's Magazine has just released an anthology called Submersion Journalism, Reporting in the Radical First Person. It's a collection of Harper's articles reported more or less undercover. It's a tricky genre involving some degree of deception, ranging from merely not disclosing that you're a reporter to outright lying and fakery. Washington Post and CNN media critic Howard Kurtz is not a fan, but
I don't think we have to go around with a bullhorn saying, press here, please let me in so that I can expose your wrongdoing. But I think there is a very significant step, a gap, between doing that and between taking on a fake name, fake business card, fake profession in order to go after what might be a very worthwhile story, but you're still lying to get it.
Here Kurtz is referring to a particular Harper's story in which writer Ken Silverstein donned a new suit and a pair of fake glasses, printed some business cards, and passed himself off as a consultant looking to hire a Washington lobbying firm to spruce up the rep of the hellaciously repressive nation of Turkmenistan. He found a couple of takers, happy to charge upwards of $1 million to seed the press and cozy up to congressmen. Silverstein named names and took some hits, as he told us in June of 2007.
I think there's a slight irony in some ways to the criticism of the undercover tactic in this case. I mean, to me, it's okay for these lobbying firms to plant op-eds and to create bogus news events and to manipulate the media. But it's not okay for me to expose their dirty linen. I find that somewhat ironic.
Is it usually bad for a reporter to lie? Sure.
Harper's senior editor Bill Wasik edited Submersion Journalism.
But in the case of Washington lobbying for foreign dictatorships, we felt like that this was an instance where it was justified for Ken to create this identity to go and get a story that he wouldn't have been able to get through any other means.
And Wasik says it received an overwhelmingly positive response. Readers pay attention when reporters go undercover. Consider Silverstein's career, says Brooke Kroger, director of the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at New York University.
You've looked back at his record. He has written about 20 pieces about Washington lobbyists since 1995, either for the Los Angeles Times or for the Harper's. Over 20 pieces. What he told me was that this is the only one that ever got serious, significant attention, a spotlight put on this issue.
Kroger wrote a biography of one of history's greatest undercover reporters called Nellie Bly, Daredevil Reporter Feminist.
She, in her very famous Insane Asylum expose, spent 10 days inside as someone who was deranged and came out to write about it in a huge two-part series that had just momentous impact and caused new monies to be brought into that facility.
Starting around 1887, Bly went undercover for a spectacular series of exposés. She spawned legions of imitators, and the practice persists to this day. Well, there was that controversial case in the 90s that looked as if it might kill undercover reporting for good when a jury found that ABC News had committed fraud when its reporters faked their resumes to work at the Food Lion grocery chain. The network was slapped with a $5.5 million fine. Here's ABC spokesperson Eileen Murphy after the ruling in 1997.
So Lyon has succeeded in convincing a jury to punish ABC for using undercover techniques that exposed its unsanitary practices. The company did so without ever challenging the truth of our broadcast, and we're obviously troubled by that.
2 years later, the ruling was overturned, though some critics did claim ABC had faked some footage, which ABC denied. The issue is one of trust. And in an age of famous fakers like the New York Times' Jason Blair and the New Republic's Stephen Glass, trust in journalism has been leaking like air from a punctured balloon. Howard Kurtz.
There's a long and colorful history of these undercover investigations, and often they do have a payoff that exposes some sort of dastardly conditions in factories or unclean conditions in restaurants or you name it. But I think that in modern journalism, that's a luxury we can no longer afford.
In many instances, it's the only way to get the story.
Pam Zeckman is an investigative reporter for Chicago's CBS affiliate.
And if the abuse is extensive enough and affects enough people, it's justified so long as you don't break the law and you don't hurt anybody in the process.
For years, she reported for the Chicago Sun-Times, and she often went undercover to expose a wrong, most notably in a 25-part series that ran in 1978, centered on a little bar called The Mirage in Chicago.
But it could be almost any neighborhood tavern, any place.
Mike Wallace narrating a 60 Minutes report on the story.
Actually, it's a story of corruption in city government. Inspectors on the take, bribed to overlook health, building, and fire code violations. Kickbacks, tax evasion. Well, several months ago, some investigators and a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times set out to determine for themselves how many of those rumors were fact in their city.
That would be Zeckman, who said that small business owners were hurting but were afraid to go public.
And we had to, in order to prove this, become them.
The Mirage was, in fact, a mirage, a bar set up by the Chicago Sun-Times. When its doors opened, the crooks poured in, taking bribes in envelopes or directly from the register, all on camera. The celebrated series was up for a Pulitzer Prize, but was stymied by Pulitzer board member Ben Bradley of the Washington Post, who disapproved of undercover journalism. Zeckman finds it frankly amusing. Now, since the Post had won a Pulitzer a few years earlier for Watergate, which relied on anonymous sources, a practice she believes is every bit as problematic as going undercover, if not more so.
I have always been a believer that the undercover technique, when there's no other way to get the story, is a truer way of getting at what's happening in an abusive area, and a more credible way for the viewer or for the reader, because they can see and hear what's happening. They don't have to trust that these anonymous sources exist. They don't have to make that leap of faith.
At least when a reporter goes undercover, you know who to trust or who not to. Harper's Bill Wasik.
When we do these first-person narrative stories, the writer comes back and essentially has to convince the reader through just an act of great writing and great journalism that what they've seen says something very important about the future of the nation or the future of the economy or technology or what have you. And so in terms of trust, it's a process that has to be built up every time.
Wasik says Harper's undercover reporters aim not so much to expose individuals as to slip past otherwise impenetrable public relations barricades to show how the world really works. Others do troll for individual evildoers, like NBC's Chris Hansen, who works with the police and uses human decoys to catch a predator.
You heard that right. He wants to take someone he thinks is a 12-year-old to a hotel for sex. But the decoy won't budge, so Cisneros gives in and shows up at the house. And he comes prepared.
So what are you doing? Did you bring condoms?
Yeah.
Sweet.
Hansen strides in, pad in hand.
I'm Chris Hansen, and I want to ask you some questions. Please have a seat.
Score.
That, for me, goes a little bit too far.
Journalist and author Brooke Kroger.
An argument could be made that law enforcement is set up to do some of those things. Is that really the role of a reporter?
So what is the role? To always be truthful to everyone, no matter who, no matter what? Former Chicago Tribune editor and publisher Jack Fuller is an absolutist.
We don't deceive our readers, and we don't deceive people we deal with, even if from time to time you end up missing a story as a result of it.
But Nellie Bly could not have exposed corruption and abuse and man's inhumanity to man without deceit. Sometimes a fake name is a ticket to a dark world of injustice desperate for the light of day.
Well, that's the best argument in favor of it. The best argument against it is that you have truth tellers lying. That's dangerous. I mean, that's the choice people have to make. You know, it's not an easy one. It's a judgment call.
The Washington Post's Dana Priest did not identify herself as a reporter to the authorities at Walter Reed Medical Center as she investigated horrific conditions there. But she did reveal herself to everyone she interviewed. She won a Pulitzer. How about Ted Conover, who revealed himself to no one when serving as a prison guard at Sing Sing for his widely admired book, New Jack? Mr. Fuller?
If they identified themselves by their own names and they never told an untruth, then I would have no problem with it.
And maybe it helps to suffer over your decision, like Ted Conover.
He tried every other possible way to do that story, but felt it was very, very important to get inside of.
Brooke Kroger.
So he approaches this with the right kind of agony, I think, and that makes his work very powerful.
Coming up in a moment, we'll hear from Ted Conover, whose agony left him with some permanent marks on his psyche, but no ambivalence about his choice.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Ted Conover teaches journalism at New York University. He's also a master of the kind of journalism we've just been discussing, the undercover kind. In his case, the kind where a writer sheds the persona of journalist and submerges himself into another way of life. For his book, Rolling Nowhere, he rode freight trains across America with some of the last remaining hobos. In his book, Coyotes, he spent a year with Mexican migrants shuttling across the border. In New Jack, guarding Sing Sing, he spent nearly a year as a prison guard in Ossining, New York. He said he likes writing where the writer is something at stake, where he doesn't depend too heavily on experts, but rather has had time to think and research and transform himself into an expert, where the urgency of the subject can transform the writing into an act of witnessing. 10 years ago, he had the urge to become that kind of expert on prison.
First thought was, well, could I be incarcerated? And the answer is yes, but then could I stop being incarcerated when I wanted to? And the answer is probably no. I thought a really interesting way to write about it would be through the perspective of guards, through correction officers. So I got assigned by the New Yorker to write about a family of officers upstate. I thought all by itself, that's interesting that generations of people work in the same prison. And got permission to visit one prison where a family I had met worked, but then I couldn't go back, and they wouldn't let me see them talking to inmates or doing the job. I'd heard about the Corrections Academy in Albany, which is a 2-month training facility, and I thought that would be interesting to see how the values of the profession are instilled in raw recruits. That could be great to watch somebody go through. And they said, oh, we never let journalists into that. And they acted like it was the CIA, but in fact, the Department of Correctional Services is the largest employer in New York State after Verizon. At that point, I thought I had passed a test for no longer declaring what I planned to do. I thought, I am going to take the corrections officer exam, and I took it. And I didn't lie on the application. I had done lots of menial jobs to support myself as a writer. I listed all of them. So I got hired.
How did you prepare yourself beyond the actual training?
You know, the training gives you good preparation for being yelled at all day by angry men who are stronger than you and for being intimidated, because that's kind of what it's about. You're in a place where people dislike you because of your uniform. You're outnumbered, and yet there are certain standards of conduct you have to maintain. And mainly they try to teach you not to lose your temper, because it's when you lose your temper that bad things happen. If you can just control yourself and not get angry and not look scared, things are usually okay.
You said that letting the prisoners out of their cells for meals felt like opening Pandora's box. Can you talk about a specific day when something really went wrong?
There were so many. Probably the worst day was the day I lost my temper. I had a trainee. I'd been there now 7 or 8 months, and she was sent to find out where everyone was going after lunch. You go to the gym, you go to the school to work on your GED, you go to the yard, and somebody has to fill out a form. She did that, and an inmate exposed himself and worse to her, and she came back looking just destroyed, and I got so angry at that guy, I went down and just yelled at him, the top of my lungs, basically. And everybody got so excited, mocking me, and I took the mirror of a guy who was using it to see when I was coming. But the next time I went by, he somehow both spit on me and swung at me at the same time and got me right behind the ear and knocked me over. And I wasn't hurt, but I was humiliated because being a CO is all about control. And the whole cell block was whooping and shouting. And it was days until I realized that the real injury I suffered was the way I felt about all inmates as I drove home that day. I hated all those guys.
You wrote that prison was full of frustration and very little catharsis. And the more you did the job, the more you longed for the use of force.
Absolutely true. And that particular day, I went and told the sergeant what happened. And his first question to me was, he swung at you out of his cell? I said, yeah. He said, why didn't you break his arm? And the thought had occurred to me. You've got this amazing leverage of having bars between the body and the end of the arm. I could have broken his arm. And such was my state that the thought was very appealing. And that's kind of nasty, isn't it? That's kind of sick. But it has a logic in prison. I did not get to exercise any force that day. He did. He felt great. I felt like a fool.
What was the most surprising thing you learned as a new Jack?
One of the most surprising things is that I could react that way. As a college-educated person who's empathetic and, you know, I thought that wouldn't happen to me. I never understood why people in prison could act the way they do. You know, you figure, oh, there's just something unhealthy in the air, but it's built into the very architecture of a prison. Who gets to move around? Who's stuck in their box? The mechanisms of locking and gates, the dehumanizing effect of that on the majority of residents of a prison, and then the corresponding dehumanization of the person who has power over them.
You were isolated from the people you were working with because they didn't know really who you were. And you were isolated from your wife because she knew who you were but didn't know what you were experiencing. Can you talk a little bit about how that affected you?
I think it's almost a fixed characteristic of any undercover experience, especially a stressful one, which I imagine most of them are. During this time, I watched Donnie Brasco, the movie about an informant. I think he's an FBI informant with the mob. And like all such stories, I mean, people know this, that it messes up your life, right? You start drinking too much. Maybe you do some of those drugs. Instead of coming home to take care of your kid and help your wife with the dishes, you stay out late and you
decompress.
Yes, or
worse,
veer off in the wrong direction, right? And it was no different for me. I wanted to spare my family the dirtiness of that job. I felt like I brought home a smell. I remember one day, Sing Sing has these long, dark corridors, and I was walking with another officer between two gates, and I slipped. And we looked down, and I had slipped in a pool of blood, because almost every day at Sing Sing, a prisoner was stabbing another one. That's kind of creepy. I'd never had that happen
you
before.
Think?
And I should have gone home and said, honey, well, it was a good day, but I slipped in blood, and that's why my pants look this way. But I took them off. I washed them. I didn't want her to know. And that, I think in retrospect, that's not the right way to handle it, you know? But mm-hmm. that is how I handled it.
So it's incredibly stressful and difficult work, but it's also kind of exciting, isn't it? Nobody knows who you are. You're writing about them. You're leading a double life. There's an element of subversion to all of this.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's how you keep going back, because every day you're seeing something none of your friends have ever seen and that most people in society don't know about. I was wearing two hats at the same time. I mean, the guard was by far what occupied my consciousness and everything else most of the day, because that was so demanding. But at some level, I was also thinking, wow, I've got to write that down. Then I could step into this little office I had. It was a cell converted to it had a desk instead of a bunk. And I'd write down like a joke. How many COs does it take to push an inmate down the stairs?
How many?
None. He fell. Okay. So I would write that down. I'd write down slang. I'd write down stuff that I knew I'd want to put into my notes. And so, yes, that is exciting to think I am just seeing amazing things, and the telling of this, it's going to be really satisfying to be able to stop someday and put all this down.
What do you say to the criticisms that there is no story worth misrepresenting yourself for?
Well, first of all, was I a guard? Yes. I was not an imposter in terms of my determination to do a good job, to do an honorable job, to do a job by the rules, to put myself on the line for the people around me the way they were doing for me. Did I fully expect to quit? Yes. Did I fully expect when I quit to write about it? Yes. Did I fully expect that some of these people I worked with would be surprised to hear that all along I'd been planning to write about it? Yes. All of that is true. But I didn't approach this particular project thinking, I'm going to go get the goods on those people, which would be one way to approach it, and not necessarily a bad way. I'm not saying it would be impossible to do that in an ethical fashion. If there was a prison, say, which was notorious, you know, which was corrupt, where bad things were happening, could a journalist feel justified in sneaking in there under false pretenses to see what was going on? I think so. I think the public has an interest in knowing, and I think that would be okay. This particular project I thought would be more interesting if I could go beyond expose to showing what it was like to do this work. So I talk about every single bad thing I saw. Everyone asked me, why don't you talk about prison rape? Well, believe me, I looked for it everywhere I thought I might find it. That's what everybody wants to know, and that's what they expect from the movies. I didn't find it. I heard about it occasionally. I wrote about that. But I didn't want to be tabloid. I thought this is going to be so interesting all by itself, just in the day-to-day examination of what it was like to do the work.
And you were sincere in your work, even as you observed and you wrote about it. On the other hand, you do describe a situation where it seems as if you felt that you might be exposed, that your cover might be blown, and therefore you had a cover.
It's true. As in so many situations when you do journalism, you don't go into every situation disclosing everything about yourself, okay? It's not just journalism. Whether you're a doctor or a salesman or a lawyer, whatever, you don't go into every situation and blurt out absolutely everything that might interest the person you're about to interact with. Now, as a journalist, does it behoove you to disclose the fact that you're a journalist? Yes, under ordinary circumstances, that's what I do. That's what I teach students to do. But there are circumstances where it's impossible if you hope to find out something important. So can that be justified in certain circumstances? I think it can. I know there are those who disagree. I was written about in the LA Times when my book came out, and the reporter called somebody from the Poynter Institute, which is like the journalist superego, as you know, down in Florida,
exactly.
Looking to make sure we all dot our I's and cross our T's in an ethical fashion. And his comment was, well, if Conover's coworkers didn't know the whole story about him, how can we as readers know he's telling the truth to us? And to me, that's a non sequitur. One doesn't lead to the other. My writing is true. It's fact-checked. It's honest. I tell what's really on my mind. Can you believe me? Well, I hope so. And I think most readers have shown that they do.
Would you do this again? I mean, in New Jack, I was frankly astonished to learn that after your 9 months, you were up to take another test and you wanted to take it. And your wife evidently said, "Are you nuts? It stops here."
They only offer the sergeant exam every 5 years. Was I going to let that opportunity slip by? I mean, who knows? This is the way I was thinking at the time. We don't know what life will bring us. I mean, look right now, the stock market crashing around us. I've always, as a freelance, felt the sort of...
You are looking as prison guard as a career to fall back on?
Well, it's a steady job, and I seem to do an okay job at it. And I thought, well, with a sergeant salary, I'd, you know... It's nuts. Of course it's nuts. But that's where my head was. And when she gave me a little shake, I was happy. But some part of me still thought, well, it couldn't hurt just to sign up. You know, it's funny. It's like Keats said, you hold two opposing ideas in your head at the same time. And one is that I'm a CO, and the other is that I'm a writer. I'm a journalist. And we all have multiple roles. I just like to think if a journalist is imaginative, he or she can find some unusual kinds of roles that have to do with the conduct of our nation. And if you have enough forbearance to put up whatever that job's going to require, that can be pretty interesting.
Do you have anything else in mind?
I have a few ideas, but I can't tell you.
You'd have to break my arm.
I wouldn't do that to you, Brooke.
Ted, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Ted Conover teaches narrative nonfiction at NYU's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute.
We began this program talking about campaign fact-checking, process of scrupulously weighing candidates' assertions in context against established facts, a laudable exercise that has recently utterly debunked, for instance, this.
Obama's one accomplishment? Legislation to teach comprehensive sex education to kindergartners.
Never mind the details. Look it up. It was a bald lie artfully constructed out of nominal facts, duly vetted and discredited by truth squads. Discredited, but not prevented. Throughout the campaign, in ads and on the stump, both McCain and Barack Obama have wantonly mischaracterized the positions and political histories of the other. Whether it's Obama fiddling with a participle to misrepresent McCain's long-reversed stand on stem cell research, or McCain sewing together irrelevancies to paint Obama as a friend of terrorism, they are both, in varying degrees, resorting to standard political operating procedure. Needless to say, if Crest or Walmart or Bridgestone tried these tactics, there would be hell, or at least a lot of lawyers, to pay. Obviously, the First Amendment gives political speech a whole lot more leeway, but free expression isn't the problem here. The problem is consequences. In the past few election cycles, there have been none. And even now, though fact-checking is a mighty hammer, it is a hammer without an anvil. Voters either don't come across fact-checks, or they hear so many of them that they throw up their hands and hold everybody, and therefore nobody, responsible. And so, not for the first time, I propose the anvil. What if, at the outset of each race, candidates were asked if they subscribe to the oath? Something like, I will not lie or misrepresent my opponent's record in positions on the stump, in my press materials, or in my advertising. Of course, that would all be on tape. The theory is that nobody could refuse to make such a pledge, and because every trespass is now documented by the opponent or the media, nobody could dare break it, lest they see an opponent's ad juxtaposing the lie, the fact check, and the oath. That's the anvil, or if you prefer another metaphor, the Straight Talk Express will be like that bus in Speed. Take your foot off the truth gas, and the whole thing explodes.
Do they think I'm doing this for fun?
Hey, that's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh and John Delore. We also had help from Michael Bernstein. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the School of Visual Arts, hosting an open house for the graduate-level program Master of Fine Arts Design Criticism on October 25th at the New York campus. More at designcriticism.sva.edu. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.